Welcome to the Leadership Experience Podcast, where we seek to build connections, talk relevant issues about warfighting, and share professional knowledge through experience and lessons learned with guests from a variety of different professional backgrounds. It's our way to relate to multiple generations within our formation and create real conversations as we build a team of teams committed to winning and dedicated to the pursuit of excellence. We hope you enjoy our content. You can continue to find the Lancer Brigade on Facebook and Instagram, and find our podcast content on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts as you search for the Lancer Brigade or the Leadership Experience. Enjoy. Hey team, check it out. Today we're sitting down with New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today best-selling author Dr. Robert Cialdini. Fortune magazine lists his book Influence in their 75 Smartest Business Books. His six principles of persuasion have become a cornerstone for any organization serious about effectively increasing their influence. Today we'll be reflecting on these six principles, as well as his research on how leaders can effectively convey these principles into increasing their influence and in turn buy-in across formations. Hey, Dr. Cialdini, I really appreciate you taking the time and sitting down and having a conversation with us today.
Of course, Colonel. Glad to be with you and your followers.
Yes, sir. Sir, I was wondering if you could share with the team, those that are not familiar with you, but, you know, you have an incredibly impressive, you know, list of accolades, and really starting from your work in the Book of Influence that I know has been referenced in so many different, you know, businesses and managers, to what you're currently doing as a professor.
Well, I am I'm retired right now from my university positions in order to write books of the sort that I've written in the past about the persuasion process, the influence process, even something that I've called persuasion, which is a little different from where I've focused in the past. In the book Influence, for example, in the book Yes, for example, I focused on what a communicator can do to put into a message the kind of information that will cause people to give assent to that message, to move in line with the communicator's goals, what you put into the message. There's this concept called persuasion that I've been working with that asks, what do you put in the message? What do you put in the moment just before you send your message that inclines people to it before they've ever heard it? Now, that sounds like some kind of magic, doesn't it? If they don't know what's in the message, how can they agree with it to a greater extent? Well, you know what's in your message before you deliver it. So if you put people in a state of mind that is aligned with the core element of your message you would like people to adopt, now when they encounter it, it will be more attractive to them. It will be more in keeping with where they are psychologically in that moment. I'll give you an example. Suppose you want people to change, right? You want them to move from where they currently are to another position that is closer to your view of what will be the best outcome for them. You want them to change to a new way of thinking or dealing with their responsibilities. You as a manager, as a leader, wants them to do that. There was a study that was done that showed that if you walk up to people on the street and hand them a flyer that says, we'll be able to send you a new brand of soft drink, a case of a new brand of soft drink for free. All you have to do is give us your email address. Well, that's risky, isn't it?
Yes.
You don't, we're told not to do that. We lay ourselves open to identity theft and so on. But, and so you only get about 29% of the people who are willing to do that. But if at the top of that flyer, it says, do you consider yourself an adventurous person? Now you've put them in mind of their adventurous nature, their willingness to take chances, to change when the situation calls for it. Now 55% turn over their, they're willing to change because at top of mind is the concept of something that is associated with change. Here's another thing that produces change. You know how at the beginning of every year, people make New Year's resolutions on how they're going to change this. It's at the start of something new, right? That they're more willing to change. Here's the interesting follow-up research. That works at the beginning of the month. If you want somebody to change, ask them at the beginning of the month rather than the end of the month, and they're more likely to do it. Now, that doesn't mean they're likely to say yes at the beginning of the month to everything. So, for example, if your goal is to have them stay the course and be true to their existing commitments, all right, that doesn't work only if you ask them to change. Now, here's the most applicable finding from this tradition of research. It also works at the beginning of the week. If you ask somebody to change on Monday or Tuesday, they're more likely to say yes than if you ask them on Thursday or Friday. So any leader who's looking for change can take what's at the top of consciousness, which is, oh, this is a new place, this is a new time, beginning of the week. Harness that for the change that is desired, and you get more movement in that direction.
That's really interesting, sir. And I love the idea that you're leading out with this in this persuasion. And I think I saw a couple of things. I think you mentioned an example in a study where it was about you had a man and a woman that were asking for a phone number, and they were talking about that same portion about, you know, setting, you know, the conditions with the thought, you know, subconsciously or consciously about romance, which then led to the, you know, just as you mentioned, you know, the challenges of handing out your email, who would hand out their phone number to a complete stranger.
That's right. So for example, in the study, this was done in France. It was done in a shopping mall, and they had a very attractive young man walk up to young women and say, excuse me, I think you're very pretty. Would you mind giving me your phone number so I can call you later for a date? Risky, right?
Absolutely.
Only 13% of the guys, only 13% of the time did the guy get a phone number. Unless he asked as the young woman was passing a flower shop. Flowers are associated with romance. Now, romance is at the top of consciousness. And if you create a situation in which the person's mindset is aligned with the request that will follow, you win.
That's really interesting. You know, as you were mentioning it and giving these examples, I think to how it's relevant in our formation, where we have soldiers that show up and integrate to a completely different way of life. And, you know, they bring a value set that's different than what we want from the organization. And there's this gap. And so we call this process, you know, this integration, sponsorship and integration. But I think some of the things that you've been able to highlight, you know, about the days of the week and how to. Yes, sir. That's right. And really priming and setting the conditions to have these individuals, whether they realize or not. And, you know, I've had this conversation with my public affairs officer. You know, right now in the Army, you know, and we are a representation of society. And there's been a lot of focus on what we call the three corrosives. So suicide, sexual assault, and racism. And so we've dedicated the time to place it where we can have these small and really hard conversations. But I think the thing that we as leaders are kind of challenged with at some point is, how do you prime the audience? How do you prime these conditions to make that change, as you're mentioning? So in your work right now with persuasion, it absolutely, I find it relevant to what we're currently dealing right now.
Yeah. And I think here's something that's not persuasion. It's more persuasion. There's a particular kind of communicator who is most successful with those individuals who are coming in different, right? Who are coming in not already harmonizing with the stated goals and practices, right? The convert communicator, the person who said, you know, I used to feel like you did, that this isn't the, you know, that there's something wrong here. There's a bad fit between me and this organization, or those directives, those goals, those purposes, they just don't mesh with me, right? I used to feel that way, and I don't now. That opens people up to the possibility of change in the direction of a particular orientation that comes from somebody just like them.
That's right.
Just like them, who also had these misgivings and so on. So that kind of communicator can be particularly compelling.
That's a very interesting point too, sir. You know, and it actually, you know, falls kind of similarly in line to a lot of things. You know, I've mentioned to the team, in order to have communication, you need to have three components: a sender, a receiver, and a feedback, you know, loop. And when I talked to Mr. Dan Coyle, who wrote Culture Code, he really talked about culture could be a skill that leaders could learn, in the sense of, you know, how do you make those that you are responsible for feel safe? Two, how do you have this shared risk? And that kind of goes back to what you were talking about, sir. It's this vulnerability loop. And so the leader shares first. But, you know, what you, I think, have just added and sharpened a little bit and almost given us another tool is it's the right leader, the right communicator that can provide some type of, you know, experience and vulnerability that says, I was once in your position, to help, you know, prime that discussion for change.
Or if that leader doesn't have that experience, can point to somebody on the squad, in the team, and said, James, can you explain how you felt? And now James, so here, the best communicator, the leader, knows when he or she is not the best communicator and gives the job to the person who in that moment is, right? You can't expect to control everything from your standpoint, your perspective, because other people have differing perspectives. And then it's just a matter of control. And that's not what persuasion is about. Persuasion is winning hearts and minds. And you do that by informing people into yes, not coercing them into yes. Yeah.
Yes, sir. You know, it's funny because a lot of times when I share things, I'll share my own personal life where I'm really trying to do persuasion and persuasion with my 16-year-old son. And you know, we've talked about a lot of times, you know, I can provide him the purpose in why I'm making him do something, the why, but I still require to earn his trust every day. Because at some point when he is facing some type of challenge, he has a choice whether or not he wants to come to me. And so I really appreciate when you mentioned who, you know, the great communicator has to realize, you know, when he is not, this is not his strength. And I almost equate that to the same point of just the, when you need a new capability or search somebody out that has the technical expertise. So there's a lot of things that I think that when, you know, I introduced to my son, but when he got to a level that I realized it was outside of my expertise, I went to go find the right individual to help him continue along that path. So that resonates with that message pretty well.
Let me give you an example from my son, Christopher, who was at the time 3 years old. And I live in Arizona. There are a lot of swimming pools and backyards. And tragically, young children fall into them every year and drown. So I was intent that Chris was going to learn how to swim at an early age. but he loved the water, but he wouldn't go in without this plastic ring, you know, this inner tube that he would wear around and he'd paddle around, and then he loved it. And it was, there was nothing I could do to get him to abandon that ring. It would, I couldn't bribe him, I couldn't reward him, I couldn't punish him, I couldn't shame him. He wouldn't go in. And I even hired one of my graduate students, big 6'2" guy, former lifeguard and swimming instructor. Chris wouldn't even go in the water with this guy. Right? Okay, so he was in a day camp at the time. And one of the features of the camp was a big swimming pool. He would never go near it. But one day I went to pick him up, and I saw him run down the diving board and jump into the deepest part of the pool. And I started to pull off my shoes because I thought I was going to have to dive in and make a rescue. Instead, he popped up without any ring, and he paddled over to the side. So I ran over there and said, "Chris, you can swim." He said, "Yes." I said, "But you're not wearing your ring." He said, "Yes." "Well, why not?" He said, "Because Tommy can swim, and Tommy's 3 years old. That means I can swim because I'm 3 years old." And I thought to myself, Cialdini. Of course, Chris is going to decide whether he is able to swim, not by looking at a 6'2" graduate student, which is what I gave him. He's going to look at somebody like him, who's the better communicator in that situation than I could have ever been. And I realized I could have saved myself a lot of aggravation and stomach if I had just gone to that camp, day camp, noticed who was about Chris's age, who was swimming without a, and then invited Tommy and his parents over to our place for a barbecue in the backyard, where the boys could swim in the pool. Chris's ring would have been on the side of the yard by the end of that day, I'm sure of it, right? So you identify who is the best communicator there. A lot of times it's the leader, because the leader has experience and perspective. That's how they got to be a leader. But a lot of times it's not. A lot of times it's somebody who you can ask to be a communicator for you of the point that you want the recipient to adopt most fully.
That's a great example, sir. I think that many can resonate with, you know, not just as parents, but at the same time, you know, what we're trying to get our soldiers to do as leaders. And sometimes we struggle with coming up with multiple approaches, as you mentioned. You know, there's a, hey, I'll bribe, I'll, you know, convince you, I'll do it with you. But you're right. That's a great example. Just in actions alone, they are not identifying with you as the best communicator with the message. So thank you for sharing that. I was wondering if we could go back in the time machine a little bit, and you talk about, as you were writing this book, you know, influence. What put you on this journey to begin with, sir?
Yes. It's an interesting question. And I have actually two answers to it. One is, I was born into an entirely Italian family in a predominantly Polish neighborhood of a historically German city, Milwaukee, in an otherwise rural state. And I recognized that when I would go from one of those settings to the other, the codes of conduct changed. The norms changed as to how people comported themselves, what they thought were the principal values and norms of the situation, and so on. And it occurred to me that if I were to optimize my my effectiveness in each of those settings, I had to adopt. There was no one right way to be. You had to adopt your communication strategy to the nature of your audience, right? You had to, and so I thought, well, that is an interesting set of questions to investigate, how those things change from group to group, from setting to setting, from situation to situation, from circumstance to circumstance. So that's one answer. The other is, all my life I've been a sucker. Really, Colonel. I would always find myself in unwanted possession. People would come to my door, they'd be selling me things or be asking me to contribute to causes I never heard of. And I would be standing there in unwanted possession of these things, or recognizing I just gave my money to some cause I never heard about. And it occurred to me, oh, so it wasn't the merits of the request that got me to say yes. It was the way the request was framed. It was how the request was delivered, and those how the merits were presented to me. It was the psychology of the process that got me to say yes, not the economics of it, right? I was paying for things I didn't want. That's not good. But the psychology of it was triggering my response. I'll give you an example for this, how I first got onto the idea of persuasion. One day I answered my door to find a man who was asking me to participate or to contribute to a cause. It was a good cause, after school programs for children in my school district. And I wound up giving him more money than I normally give to people who come to my door asking for contributions, even with, all the proper credentials, the United Way or the American Cancer Society or something like that. I gave him about twice as much. And afterwards, I closed the door and I thought to myself, what just happened here? Really? What just happened here? This guy just got me to give him twice as much money as I normally did. And he didn't use any of the principles of influence that I put in my book, Influence. He didn't cause me to like him more by complimenting my landscaping. He didn't use what we call social proof by saying, oh, all your neighbors have already given. He didn't use authority by showing me some article that says the experts say how important after-school programs are for kids who are latchkey kids who don't have their parents at home. They need interest. He didn't do any of those things. He didn't even use the scarcity principle that said, we have to do it now in order to have the programs in place next semester. Here's what he did. He brought his 2-year-old daughter with him. And he focused me on children. Focused me on children and the challenges of children and the needs of children and the value of children and their education, right? And before he said a word, I was leaning in his direction. Then when he gave me the pitch about after school program for children, he took me the rest of the way there. Right? So, yeah. These things, and here's the thing that I think is, I count as, I'm fortunate. When he left and I closed the door, I did what I always do when I'm puzzled. I thought, How did that happen? How did that happen? And it wouldn't leave me alone. The question wouldn't leave me alone until I thought more about it. When I have a puzzle, when I have some sort of mystery, how could that have occurred? It doesn't leave me alone until I've thought it through, figured it out, or in my case, done some research to investigate.
And I was wondering, I heard you speak on a couple of different episodes, and you mentioned as you went on this journey, so now you have this puzzle, this riddle. How did this happen? How did I, you know, as you said, became a sucker? Is that true about how you ended up collecting all this data, that you went undercover and volunteered for all these different jobs to gain this?
It is true, girl. What I did, where I first of all, I became an experimental social psychologist to understand how all this works, right? And I was trained in how to do experiments, but those experiments were done almost entirely in my laboratory on a college campus using college sophomores as my subjects. And it seemed to me that was a very narrow lens through which I was viewing this process. And it seemed to me that there's a much larger experiment going on all around me than I could ever conduct in my laboratory. And that is, there are professions whose business it is to get us to say yes to them. Salespeople, managers, marketers, advertisers, fundraisers, recruiters. And I thought, okay, they will know what really works outside of a laboratory to get people to move in their direction. If they didn't, they'd go out of business. Right? They wouldn't be in their job for very long. So they must know. So how do I get the information that they already have banked but won't give out, because they don't want their competitors to know what they've learned that works for them? So I decided I would answer ads to be a trainee in as many of these influence professions as I could get access to. So I would learn how to do it from the inside, and I would be taking notes. I had a tape recorder. They thought, oh, this guy, this guy is really committed to us. But then at the end, I would, of course, have to say, here's the truth. I'm not a prospect. My name isn't Rob Calder, and I'm not a prospective automobile used car salesman. But I'm a university professor, and I need to get your permission to use the information that I've gleaned from being in your training program in this book that I plan to write. And there were two things that got them to say yes to me. One was, I used one of the principles that's in the book, the principle of reciprocation, that says people give back to you after you've first given to them. So I said, and even if you say no, just for allowing me to spend time in your training programs, I'm going to send you a copy of the book pre-publication before anybody else has it. I'm going to give you an advantage over all of your competitors for knowing what I found out about what causes people to say yes to requests, right? Recommendations, proposals. So I gave them something first, right? But here's something I did that I never expected would work. I didn't intend for it to work this way. I was just honestly telling them, look, I'm a university professor. I study persuasion and social influence, and I wanted to learn how it worked from people who were professionals and practitioners who really understood the process. And they would say to me, wait a minute, you're a college professor who's an expert on this? And we're your teacher? And I said, yes. And they would puff up their chests and say, of course you can use our material. Because I gave them the label of teacher. And what do teachers do? Teachers don't covet information. They don't make it proprietary. Teachers give out information. So I gave them a reputation, teacher, to live up to. So here's another hint I would give to leaders. You want to see a certain behavior occurring more frequently within your team or a particular individual? When you see that behavior, compliment the person on it and say, I really appreciate how you're always prepared for meetings. Or you come to meetings so often prepared, or that you are a good listener, right? You're now going to get more of that. You've just given people a reputation to live up to by assigning them that trait. So you don't say, I really appreciate how you did it this time. You say, I really appreciate this about you. And now people are going to live up to you. So I compliment people differently these days. I compliment them by giving them reputations to live up to that I want to see them confirm further in the future. I do that with my students now. It works.
That's a great technique, and I think that's something that's absolutely that our leaders can apply. I mean, right off the bat, for those that are going through, especially they're integrating and just going through some different challenges, is because as adjusting to the profession of arms, it could be a little bit different from where, you know, soldiers had come from, as you mentioned, you know, just as you were growing up. I really appreciate, you know, you going through that story, sir, and really talking about the beginnings. As I was walking through, you really talked those six principles. And I know we've already talked reciprocity. And for us here in the brigade, one of the things when I was reading through it, when you kind of talked about it, it's this obligation to give when you receive something. And for me, I looked at it as it's those leaders that right off the bat, you know, that are providing that initial impression when a soldier comes in. And I truly believe it's how, it's almost now, as you've highlighted, it's almost even how you compliment and then what you're doing to invest. I think where we see it is, I truly believe in that, really that very beginning, that first 30 to 60 to 90 days is when a soldier is making that determination and just now reinforcing whether or not they want to continue to do this past their initial term of enlistment. And the second part that I thought that was really, really interesting was when you talked about the principle of reciprocity. We talk about this golden hour in the military. It was referred to as a medical term to try to get a soldier from the point of injury to the next level of echelon of care. We take that same principle and we talk about the golden hour when a family comes in. So it's one thing from the soldier, you know, who comes integrated and is sponsored into the actual force where we're going to be teaching him the warfighting profession. But here in the profession of arms, it's wrapping their arms around the family who's trying to come to a new location, get a new house, find a job in the area. And a lot of times I've seen those families that have received, you know, as this reciprocity principle early on, when they see others experiencing the same things, they're the ones willing to lend out a hand.
Yeah, right, because they've received, yeah. That's right. Well, this is interesting, the idea of family, and because I'm writing a revision of my book, Influence, right now. And I've added a seventh principle. It's the principle of unity, which is the sense that not just... It's not that I would say, Colonel Chung is like us, right? That's something else. That's similarity. Unity is Colonel Chung is one of us. He's of us. Right? If you can get me to say those words about you, all influence is easier. I will cooperate with you. I will believe you. I will help you. I will support you because you're of me. Right? That whole principle on which people decide whether to say yes or not is as powerful as any of them that I identified in the first version of my book.
Well, what was the reason you were looking at a seventh principle, sir? What was the experience or the occurrence that happened that made you relook the seventh principle?
Well, I had seen it in the past. I had seen this sort of, if I identify with a particular group, if I really truly share an identity with those individuals, things are easier. But I always thought it was something that just augmented the other principles. If you have that, then reciprocity is easier. Authority is easier. Scarcity is anything that you use. And then I realized, no, actually, this is a separate principle. It works just by itself. Just knowing that somebody else is of my identity, right, shares my identity, is enough to make people move in that direction. So, for example, just there's a study that it was done in Great Britain where there were they did a fake somebody was walking down the street and then tumbled over. What is that, right? What is that? Should I help that person? Is that just a drunk sleeping one off over there? What is that? If that person was wearing a shirt of the soccer team for that city, Manchester, people were significantly more likely to help. He's one of us. Right. So anything you can do to to communicate a shared identity with people will be great for your influence skills.
That's interesting that you bring that up, sir, because, you know, when I was going through this and as we were doing some research and I found out that you had a seventh principle and you were talking about unity, and there's two terms that we use in the military. You know, we use unity at command, and as you've highlighted here, when we're talking persuasion, it's not about command and control, you know, but there's this other concept. When you get to a certain level of leadership, as you become an organizational leader and they all don't fall with under your one command or in the same unit, there's key stakeholders. You build consensus building and you have to have this thing called unity of effort to move towards certain things. And so it's interesting that you're highlighting that, because I think that just in that last example that you mentioned, there's a lot of things that resonate. And you can hear that when we a lot of times when you hear speeches or you're talking about, you know, things at a memorial or inspiration, that the soldiers that are all united by a common purpose are doing it for those that are to the left and right of them. You know, and they may all come from different walks of life, but the moment that they all have chosen to do something that less than 1% of the population has done, then now it's very similar. It's even more powerful than just wearing the Manchester United jersey. But I think that resonates, you know, that last principle very, very well in the profession of arms.
I agree. And one of the things that fosters that sense of unity is cooperation. So there was a classic study in which some researchers put in a boys' camp, put kids in one cabin versus in another, gave them names Rattler and Eagle, and then put them in a situation where they competed against each other, and they hated each other as a consequence of being rivals. And they now, how do you reduce that sense of separation and animosity? What they did was to structure situations in which they had to work together to achieve a common goal. So they arranged for the only truck available in the camp to go to the town and get food, to be stuck down a ravine. So all the kids had to pull together in order to get they did a series of those kinds of things where all the kids had to work together in order, and all of a sudden those animosities drifted away, and there was a sense of unity among the group that came from working together for a common goal and succeeding as a result.
Yeah, sir. I mean, you can even see if you're looking at the poster behind me. So our brigade is called Lancers, but every one of the seven battalions has their own names, as you mentioned. You know, so like Tomahawks and Buffalo, but they all may be rivals and compete with all these different things, but the moment they step outside the footprint, they're all Lancers. And so, you know, and you're exactly right. If you don't have this nested concept, then there's a lot of things that are going to be challenged with. And I think that, you know, partly because of myself and other things just in the nature and order, because time is a resource that we're always looking more of, you have to find ways that puts these teams together. So they love to compete with one another, but at the same time, they also love to solve problems together when it's required, together as a brigade. It's almost kind of recognizing whose team is on the field. So is it the time where, you know, you are a Tomahawk, you're a Buffalo, you're a Mustang, or is it the time when now everybody's wearing the same jersey? So I appreciate you sharing that example. Hey, sir, so we talked unity, we talked reciprocity. I was wondering if you could just quickly highlight a couple of the others for the team that's not familiar with your work, as experienced as I am of going through this the last couple of days. Scarcity, I thought that was that was something that I kind of smiled at it, you know, a lot of times to persuade somebody when they recognize that they want more of something that they don't necessarily know that they're going to have, or something that ends up leaving.
Yeah, scarcity is it's a powerful one. A supermarket chain that went back through its promotions, in-store promotions with signage and so on, for 10 years to see which was the promotion that was most successful in getting people to buy some item on the shelf. And it was a scarcity promotion. If they said limited time sale, right, or only 3 items per customer, they doubled the effect of any other promotion they had had. So things that are dwindling in availability, things that are rare or scarce, are you have limited access to, people want them more. So one of the things I always talk about to leaders is the idea of emphasizing what is unique, what's uncommon about our group, our mission, our purpose, our team. It's not like it's something that's necessarily going away. It's just something you can't get elsewhere. That kind of unity, that kind of scarcity is easy to identify and then make sure that everybody recognizes, because that's what they want to be. They want to be distinctive. They want to be part of something that you can't get anywhere else.
So that's a great point. I mean, the first example you mentioned for scarcity, that sounds like my six-year-old son who always comes in there to advertise why this is a one-time deal and we have to run out at this point to purchase something, whether it's a video game or, you know, some pair of shoes. But, you know, more importantly, and I think that's the part where my public affairs officer, as we sit down, it's how do we communicate this message? When you come to this team, here is the experience that you're going to have. That is not like there's other brigades in the Army, but here's the experience that you're going to be afforded when you get to serve with the Lance Brigade. And I think that I appreciate you highlighting that, because those that don't understand, I saw scarcity as that principle that if used not ethically, could be used in a different way versus persuasion.
Well, it's true. Any of these principles could be used for good or ill. It's like dynamite. You can build a bridge using dynamite. You can blow up a bridge. So what do you want? Do you want that bridge built or blown up? So you can use any of these principles honestly or deceptively. The problem with the second of those is that people eventually catch on, and then they don't believe anything you have to say. Even what you're saying that might be true, that you're gone. You're not a credible communicator any longer. So you're finished.
And then we move down to authority, sir. And I know I've heard you talk about it in the example of, you know, somebody that walks into a doctor's office and they want to identify and follow people that are credible and knowledgeable. So I was wondering, in our profession, when I saw that, it's a lot of times those that have been to combat. And, you know, when you sit there and you have a mission, whether you're getting ready to deploy, to go overseas, you're doing all this training, and it's very easy for you to communicate that says, what I am going to teach you, you are going to apply when you need to on the battlefield.
That's right. And you've hit on something that a lot of people miss when they think about the concept of authority. They think about being in authority as opposed to being an authority. In authority is about hierarchical control, right? Command. Fine, that works. But there are some costs there, right? If that's the only thing you've got, the I am the boss card is the only one you can play. Being an authority means you're somebody people want to listen to because you have experience, you have knowledge, you have background that they can learn from that they don't have. So that's the form of authority that we think is most important in the persuasion process. Honestly giving people evidence of your experience, credentials, and so on.
And sir, moving down to consistency, I think that's, you know, as you mentioned, looking for and asking for commitments that could be made. You know, I looked at it as an example where, you know, the slightest little bit, you mentioned, I think, in an example where if somebody was asked to put this sign in their yard, you know, no one wanted to do it, but in another town over, you know, everybody would. But before that, as we talked about kind of prepping before, they were asked just to put something very small, like a little index card in their window. So when it came time to actually ask to put the sign in there, they were actually had the commitment to do that.
Right. And the sign in those cases was drive safely. Okay. So a little sign, nobody said no to, would you put a little 3x5 index card in your window that said driver safety week. Nobody said no to that. But now you come a week later and said, can we put a driver safety sign on your lawn? Most people said no, unless they had agreed to put that little sign in their window a week earlier. That initial commitment had legs. It stretched into the future and caused people to want to be congruent with it.
Well, yes, sir. The other thing that I thought was applicable when you're talking, the principle of consistency is the power of just your own internal commitment by writing things down.
Yeah.
we've had, you know, several guests that have talked about the power of journaling. We've even seen it in our own craft. You know, leaders that have gone back and really gone back to reflect of what they wanted to do. How did that conversation go? What could I have done better? Did I actually get the message? And so just the easiest little example where you mentioned you would go to the dental appointment or go to a hospital and they would tell you what the appointment is, but they would give you a card so the actual, you know, individual could write it down. Just that little bit of writing is whether you realize it or not, your own little small act of commitment.
That's right. And, you know, for me, there's a danger there. I don't sign petitions any longer. Even for things I am in favor of, because once I sign that petition, unless I want to move forward with it, unless I want to for that to be a spur to get me to take the next step further, right? I don't sign petitions because once I do that, I've made myself committed to a cause that I should want to be consistent with subsequently. That's what written commitments do. They put me on record, right, as supporting this cause. And then I would have to be two-faced or inconsistent, right, if I said this but didn't follow through on it. And I don't like thinking of myself that way. So I don't even take the first step anymore unless I want it to be a spur, to be a prod to get me to go to the next level.
You know, sir, when I was listening to part of the discussion on this principle, I go back to the example where, you know, when young leaders come into this profession and before they've had any experiences, they're like sponges. And that's what I offer to them, to write down what they believe good leadership is, what they believe, you know, the great leadership traits are in their own mind. And then as they go through, you know, For example, when I went to the academy, I wrote down about 3 pages of what I thought great leadership was. And every time that I leave that assignment, I pick that up and I read it again. And I ask myself if I still believe it. Because, you know, as you run into the different leaders as they get older, they're going to say, hey, I always thought that way. Because, you know, these are the same people I hang around with. But the only true, as we've talked about here, the commitment to yourselves is if you write it down. So I love even just the smallest act of not signing a petition is still that portion about being a spur, as you mentioned.
Right. The other thing that augments writing it down is making it public, Ben, because now you've told other people that this is what you could, and you're motivated to not just be consistent within yourself, but to be consistent within the eyes of others who are going to judge you.
That's exactly right. So, sir, I was wondering, just take us home and finish it up there with the with liking and consensus.
Well, consensus is the thing that I think is now, we call it social proof these days. It's the thing that has been changed the most in modern times because of the internet. It is the perception that if a lot of other people are like me, around me, are doing something, it must be the right thing. Because look, all those people are doing it. It's easy for that to happen. And one thing we frequently forget when we try to move people in a particular direction is to say, you know, this is the thing that people like you most frequently choose of the various options, right? They will then move in that direction instead of staying on the fence and hesitating and so on. Give them a reason to move in a particular direction by honestly telling them what is the most popular of the options, and then they act. That's one. The other is liking. And we already talked a little bit about that. giving people compliments, genuine compliments that they deserve. That's one. The other thing about liking that works very well is to uncover similarities, things that are comparable, a parallel about you. There was a study done of negotiators who were significantly less likely to deadlock in the negotiation if before they began, they exchanged information about one another, what their hobbies were, what their interests were, what their family life was, and so on. And the researchers thought, oh, that's because now they have humanized one another. They are not just an opponent. They're a real person on the other side of the table. It turned out that wasn't the reason. It wasn't how much information they got about the other person. It was whether there were commonalities. Oh, you're a runner? I'm a runner. You're a firstborn? I'm a firstborn. You're an only child? I'm an only child. You have twins? I have twins. Whatever it was, that was the key that caused people to meld together and give the other grace in the negotiation. And the number of deadlocks went from 30% to 6% just by sending information back and forth. So leaders need to identify genuine similarities that they have with the people on their team, raise them to the surface, and there's a built-in starter toward agreement as a result.
Great point, sir. You know, I challenge the team a lot of times. If I could grab a squad and gave you 2 minutes, could you identify five things that all of you have in common? So a squad generally can go up to about nine individuals, anywhere from about five to six. If I gave you 2 minutes, could you all write down, hey, here are the five things that we all have in common? You know, we're from this state, we like this team, or whatever the case is. And then for the other, you know, the team that's listening, you know, senior leaders a lot of time will say that our strategic center of gravity is increasing the relationship with our partners and allies. And so for us here being stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, a lot of times our focus is, you know, there's a lot of exercises, but these exercises is to build, you know, some camaraderie and build increased capability and capacity with partners and allies all within the Indo-Pacific AOR. And so before we were preparing to actually, you know, conduct some of these exercises where we were working with, you know, it didn't matter if it was the Thai, Philippine Army, as we were walking through, you know, the something as simple as just playing the sport of soccer or basketball together can bring this commonality together before you actually end up doing any training and may end up having some differences or, you know, any challenges that you got to work through, resources or anything like that. And one of the things that a mentor also offered to our team was, it's not just playing a sport that you may have in common that both you agree upon, but actually integrate the teams. So you're all on the same team, not playing against each other, that when, you know, you have a commonality that you just added to increase the gap and the differences between the two.
You know, we have a small company that does training and consulting, and sometimes we'll have a client, we'll go to their offices, and they'll have a meeting room, and we're going to negotiate a contract, something, and we used to go in, we get there first, we sit on one side of the table, the clients would come in, they'd sit on the other side, and it was the geography of difference. We created a difference. So now I ask my team to take every other seat. Now in comes the client's team. They look, what is this? But they don't say, hey, go to your side. They come and sit among us. Remarkable difference.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They, you know, I've had that same similar experience. You know, a lot of times it doesn't matter if it's your higher headquarters coming down or as you may be familiar with corporate. You know, how do you establish that room so it's not in this standoff, you know, especially when the topic or the challenge can be very, very difficult to begin with. And I also thought, I also thought that, you know, it's also applicable. That's the opportunity to show some vulnerability, to open up some of those commonalities as you're working through some of these things that could be kind of challenging as you will. But I think all great examples you've laid out. Hey, sir. So I was wondering, in this time of COVID, when you don't, and you don't have the ability to do the face-to-face that you have, a little bit some more distributed communications, you know, and I know you wrote these principles, you know, back in the 80s, and now you've added this seventh one on. What advice would you give to the team that doesn't have that opportunity to have this face-to-face as much as they have and has to rely a little bit more on distributed comms? To establish this thing of either whether it's prime for the persuasion or to actually put into practice the how of these principles of influence.
Yeah, I would use the principle of social proof, which is that the great majority of us do undertake the steps to reduce the problem, right? And convert communicator. Somebody who says, you know, I used to think that I was invulnerable. I didn't think this was a real deal. Wait a minute. That's not true anymore. I've come around to that side because of what I've seen or what I've learned, right? Somebody just like that person who's resisting has now become the convert communicator who's more likely to move them because they were like them.
I think that's a great point. It ties us right back to the beginning, sir, or even at the same point, if you're not that individual, finding somebody that can help you with that check-in as you're going through. Yes, sir. So, hey, Dr. Cialdini, I really appreciate you taking the time and having this great conversation. I think that the things you've laid out and the accolades of your work that have not just been applicable to, you know, business managers and leaders in the civilian world, but can absolutely resonate, and our leaders in our formation can use them all the way from myself down to squad and team leaders who are in charge of 3 to 5 individuals. And every time our team will be listening to this, I always leave them with a question of, you know, or I always leave them with, what are your questions? But I'd like to leave the final word with you, sir.
The final question or the final word?
The final word. Yes, sir.
People ask me, of all these principles, which is the most powerful? Which is the one I should use regularly to get the biggest effect? And I answer by saying, I had a colleague who decided to find the single most effective persuasive approach, right? Of all that. And I saw him at a conference. He spent 2.5 years and he said, I found it. Bob, I found it. The single most effective persuasive approach is not to have a single persuasive approach. That's a fool's game. To think that the same situation, the same approach is going to be optimal in all different situations with all different audiences who have all different kinds of history with you, that's ridiculous. You use the principle that's naturally in the situation, waiting for you to use it. If you genuinely have scarcity, that's the one you use. If you genuinely have social proof, that's the one you use. If you genuinely have authority voices, that's the one you use. That's the way to be most effective.
Well, sir, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to The Leadership Experience. If you like what you heard, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with the newest podcasts. The Leadership Experience will showcase professionals within 5 different subseries. Number 1, Masters of Our Craft, The Essence of Warfighting. Number 2, Students of Our Profession, as we understand organizational culture and concepts of leadership. Number 3, Professional Athletes with Guns, as we talk hardships and maintaining a competitive advantage. Number 4, grit and resiliency, the ability to overcome and perform under pressure. And number 5, safe and secure environment, as we talk soldier well-being and building trust within our organization and the profession as whole.